I think everybody is back, and welcome to everyone. I'm just going to run down the list to let everybody know who's here. We usually go around the room, Ryushin, and greet each other, but we do it just down the list in the era of the pandemic. So we have Bob. We have Ryushin, our guest speaker, Adine, Vin, Bruce, Claudia, Jeannie, Jessica, Jim, Linda, Lisa. That's so on. Sorry. Mark, Marvin, Mary, Pat, Paulette, Ruth Ann, Sam, Shoketsu, Cinda, Susan, and Yeshe. I hope I didn't miss anybody. We also usually do announcements at this time, and I don't know of any announcements that need to be made. So if somebody wants to unmute themselves. If not, then I'll go ahead and introduce our teacher today. And we're so grateful that you're here, Ryushin. Ryushin is a Zen priest and a social worker, and he lived and trained at Great Vow Zen Monastery with, and some of us know, Chozen and Hogen. He was ordained in 2005 and recently received his Dharma transmission. And he has a lot of education and background in social work, especially mental health and addiction and trauma counseling and so forth down in Corvallis. He's joining us from Corvallis. So welcome again, Ryushin, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be with you this morning and to get to practice together in these strange times that we're in. It's always different to go into a sangha that I'm less familiar with and understand the culture and the norms. So often like to share that my understanding of how to engage with a Dharma talk is to see them as a type of zazen. So not that you have to, you know, cast your eyes down and anything to that extent, but rather to continue to practice and to be at least as attentive to what's happening internally as you are to the content, the things that I'm sharing. And a couple quotes that have guided me as I was reflecting on what to share today. One is by Carl Jung. It says, "One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. This procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not very popular." And then Dogen Zenji said, "To study the Buddha way is to study the self." So, as Jinyu mentioned, I have different identities that come together in this particular body, heart, and mind. And the primary identities that I'll be speaking from are as a Dharma teacher, as a social worker, and as a white person. Because this is a talk about the Dharma and it's a talk about racism and how those two weave together. So to start by just sharing a little bit about my background as a white person, that I was raised in a small coastal town in New Jersey. Population was about 90-ish percent white, and then some Hispanic Latinx, some smaller percentage of Asian and Black, Pacific Islander, And I don't remember the first person of color that I saw. I don't remember if I asked my parents the question, you know, why is that person, why is their skin so dark? If I did, I don't remember what they responded. I lived in a very white neighborhood and my school was very white. I never remember feeling afraid of people of color. And the first time I can recall being clearly aware that I was afraid of people based on their skin tone alone was when I was in college in Norfolk, Virginia, which has a very different demographic, about 41% white currently, 43% Black or African American. And I signed up for a History of Africa class my freshman year. The class was 30 people and I showed up. 27 people were Black or African American, 3 white students. And I remember very distinctly feeling nervous for no obvious reason other than feeling outnumbered. I remember sweating. I remember double checking that the door was open. And I remember looking nervously at the other 2 white students. One was male, one was female. I don't remember if the students sitting to my left or right were male or female. I just remember that they were Black. So as I share that story, notice for yourself how you're responding internally. Feeling calm, feeling nervous, bored, drowsy, irritable, engaged. Notice any thoughts that are arising. The Buddha's first teaching after his enlightenment was the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth states that there is dukkha, which could be translated as suffering or stress or pain, and said that birth and aging and illness and death are dukkha. Getting what you want is dukkha. Losing what you enjoy is dukkha. Not getting what you want is dukkha. And each of the Four Noble Truths has a task that's associated with it. So the point to emphasize is that the task of the First Noble Truth is suffering is to be fully understood. And as I experience it, that task is challenging for at least 2 reasons. The first being that most people don't want to fully understand dukkha. We all want it to go away, but fully understanding is not usually the route that we choose. It's not our first go-to. And also fully understanding dukkha is challenging because some dukkha is harder to see. It's harder to see when we get a new car or a new whatever, that includes the disappointment when it gets scratched, damage or breaks down, that the excitement, the joy, the passion of a new relationship includes that eventually that will involve going separate ways or someone dying, that the coming together includes the separation. So I'll make a bold claim that the Buddha did not specifically state that racism is dukkha. And that if we want to decrease dukkha, which is what the Buddha said his path was about, he said, I teach about dukkha and the end of dukkha. If we want that we have a responsibility to understand racism, and particularly how it manifests in our own hearts, minds, our own karmic stream. And that it is possible to radically transform our relationship with it. And like dukkha, fully understanding racism takes a serious commitment. So, again, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. And as Americans, part of our self is the culture that we're swimming in. which we inherit from our ancestors. And that includes our family, you know, the way that we inherit eye color, risk for high blood pressure, how we understand marriage and work from our family. And it includes our society, that we inherit concepts like pull yourself up by your bootstraps, or thinking of American apple pie as American, even though our country doesn't follow absolute meritocratic system. And the phrase apple pie, as I looked into it, seems to have originated to sell suits back in the 20s. So we inherit a mixed bag of ourself, of the things that set us up for success and the things that we have to come to an awareness of and choose consciously to release and to release and to release and to release. And we live in a country that is designed to benefit people with lighter skin and harm at the disadvantage of people with darker skin. More locally, we live in a state that was founded as a white utopia. Some of you may be aware that Oregon's constitution includes the declaration that, quote, no free Negro or mulatto not residing in this state at the time of the adoption of this constitution shall come, reside, or be within this state, or hold any real estate. If you weren't aware of that, notice how you feel coming into contact with that part of our history. And of course, that statement was officially removed from our state constitution. It's somewhat concerning, to me at least, that it was only removed 20 years ago. And that history continues to influence Oregon's demographics. We're still a state that 87% white. There's a reason for that. So, not only, as I understand it, is racism not separate from our Dharma practice, it is especially important work of studying the self for people who identify as white or are identified as white. Many white people as a group find it difficult to discuss race and feel uncomfortable when it comes up. Are you feeling relaxed in your heart and mind? Are you feeling anxiety, irritability? This is one aspect of studying ourself. And some people, white people, will say that we're not as bad as fill in the blank, Mississippi, say. So it's not, there are other things that need our attention. Again, if the first task that the Buddha gave in terms of Dharma is to fully understand dukkha, then understanding racism internally and externally is important, whether it's pervasive or not, whether it's as bad or not. And admittedly, the Southern Poverty Law Center found that Oregon was in the top 10 first of states for the number of hate groups to the general population as of 2018. So we may still have some work to do. And another common response of white people as a whole is saying that we're not racist, and kind of end of conversation. So returning to my example as a young college student, if someone had asked if I was a racist at that, before that event, after that event, I would have said, no, absolutely not. What I was able to understand of that experience was that I was anxious and that I knew that my anxiety was not based on a genuine threat. And it took over a decade to realize, or more, to realize that my anxiety was based on a racist cultural indoctrination that Black people are dangerous. I would not have understood that. And I would suggest that it's not possible to be not a racist in a racist culture. the image that comes up is, it's like being on a boat that's propelled by unpaid workers that are rowing down under. And me sitting on the deck chair saying, the treatment of those workers doesn't involve me, it's not really accurate. I'm on the boat, I'm either agreeing with it implicitly or explicitly, or I'm moving against it. And for an racist culture, doing nothing supports racist norms, where the alternative is being anti-racist. One of my favorite social workers is Brené Brown. And she says that people don't want to be seen as racist because there's so much shame associated with that, which I get. And she says, but people don't want to be seen as anti-racist because there's so much work associated with that. So I'm discussing this process of bringing darkness to conscience, to conscious. And it's important in that, and all of our dharma work, spiritual practice, to notice our very human tendency to orient towards comfort. I had the really wonderful privilege of getting to meet Ajahn Sumedho, who was an American Thai forest elder. He was ordained about 50 years ago, and he came to the monastery while I was living there. And in the course of the conversation, one of the more notable things that I heard him say was, and he was an abbot at this point, he had been 10 years or 40 years of personal practice, observing other people, teaching other people. He said, people often use the Buddhist teachings to justify their own desires. It's much better to ask oneself, what makes me afraid? And I notice for myself that tendency is so strong even when things are going well. And things are not going well right now, right? There is no doubt that we are in challenging times 6 months into this pandemic, too many people still believing that it's a hoax and that masks are a political tactic of oppression. And nearly half of the US population is unemployed. We're in a recession. We've got a decreasing window of time to change our carbon footprint. There's just thing after thing after thing after thing. And at the same time, these are the times when we're pushed to an edge where there's also the possibility to realize that following our desires is not the way out. I was just recently hearing someone who looked back on Gandhi's life and noted that he went through an internal shift around 1919. It was quite possible that he was very sick. It's quite possible that he had the 1918 flu, and he thought he was going to die. And in the midst of that, lying on his bed, not being sure whether he was going to live or not, he came to radically shift his perspective on the strategy for the freedom of India and how he as an individual wanted to be. It didn't have to go that way. Corrie ten Boom, who was a Dutch woman who hid Jewish community members in her home during World War II, she was sent to a concentration camp, and in her book, she said, shifting the language slightly because she's speaking from a Christian context, that you only know that the Dharma is all that you need when the Dharma is all that you have. So spiritual practice, as I understand it, it challenges us to grow continually, wiser and kinder and more grateful and more generous. And that generally involves allowing the circle of what our definition of spiritual life to keep expanding out. And Dogen Zenji, as many of you know, goes on in the quote to say, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas. To be enlightened by the 10,000 dharmas is to free one's body and mind and the body and mind of others. I'm offering the perspective that studying the self is exactly as important as the forgetting the self. And that we all have blind spots. Places where we need to grow and change and we can't quite, it's just out of sight. Which is one reason why the Buddha created a Sangha, to have community, to be honest with each other. There are many teachings of the Buddha, or attributed to the Buddha, where he acknowledges Sangha members' responsibility to encourage each other towards greater wisdom and compassion. That's what we're here for. You may have heard the image of Sangha being like potatoes in the water. You put the dirty potatoes in the water and you just bump them together. And as they bump together, they knock the dirt off. Not always the most comfortable process if you're a potato, but, you know, gets the job done. So this is a particular moment when white people as a group appear to be more conscious that racism is occurring and connecting with the pain and loss that it brings for them or for others. I personally feel like there are pains and shames and consequences that come for those that have the lighter skin too. And so it feels important in this moment to emphasize how understanding and unlearning racism is part of the Dharma. Because again, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. So those were some reflections that I wanted to share. And now as I understand it, we turn around and open it up to conversation, questions, random bits of wisdom.
Well, I wanted to thank you for what you shared with us so far. And it is very apropos for us, not only because of what's going on these days in society, but also because last week we had our first of 6 Awakening to Whiteness sessions. Wonderful. So a fairly large group of us will be going through that process over the next 6 months, led by Shoketsu, who is on the call with us today. I particularly liked the boat image of the folks rowing down below and me sitting on the deck. I will admit that for the longest time, it was difficult for me to relate to what I was doing or not doing, really not doing, that allowed racism to continue as it has been. So I love that image. I think that's very helpful because I'm guessing that a lot of people can't relate in that way.
Yeah. Thank you, Janu. Thank you for sharing and for reflecting your experience. And as I also have, in addition to my formal Dharma practice and practice, seen shame and shame resilience work. So Brené Brown's work in applying that for the last 7-8 years. And as we talk about racism, I feel like we're talking about shame and nobody wants to talk about shame either, do we? Right? So it's a perfect storm of things that we don't want to talk about. But as shame researchers like Brené Brown point out, everyone experiences shame. No one wants to talk about shame. And the less we talk about shame, the more we experience it. And that shame is experienced as trauma. When we feel ashamed, whatever the situation might be, because we are telling ourselves a story that we're lazy, or we're telling ourselves a story that we're stupid, or we're a failure, or we're worthless, or, you know, fill in the blank with your favorite, you know, way that you like to flagellate yourself, that the internal experience is roughly approximate to if we were in a traumatic situation. If we were going down the road and somebody swerved into our lane and we had to quickly respond, there would be that same, for me, it's a tension in the gut, heat in the chest, sweating in the shoulders. And so that makes it just that much harder to have these conversations, right? Because we're not just dealing with racism, we're dealing with the shame in the sense of I'm a failure. And that, like, that feels like as important a part to turn towards and see through. Because it's so easy. The system is designed for us to see it.
You were talking about, speaking about, you know, some of connecting to what you were just saying, also Brené Brown's studies of, you know, people don't want to see themselves as racist because the shame involved. But on the other hand, people don't want to see themselves as anti-racist because there's so much work involved. From the work you've been doing and your perspective, what's a good place to start the work that's involved in being an anti-racist?
Wow. Thank you for the question. I personally stumbled into it. I mean, we can look at it in many different ways, but in terms of like intentionality, I feel like there were larger forces at play. I started it, because my partner at the time was going through her social work program, and she was doing an internship at the Portland Women's, what was then called the Portland Women's Crisis Line. And I wanted to volunteer there to be the first male advocate on the Women's Crisis Line. And they have a, I think it's 60-hour advocacy training, which includes pieces about domestic violence and oppression and racism and all these different really important topics. But I had no idea what I was getting myself into. It was very intense. So honestly, I feel like wherever someone's inspiration is, like I'm so happy that your Sangha is engaging in this Awakening to Whiteness curriculum. I am in the process of putting together something similar based around the book White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, trying to approach it from a Buddhist context, similar 6-week piece. I feel like the work is hard enough that to find the way that you can honor and respect your own limits, because it's not about drowning ourselves, right? It's not about, okay, I need to jump off the boat and I don't know how to swim and now I'm drowning, right? That's not helping. But what can I do that is within my boundaries is so much more, because we're growing. We have to keep growing within our limits. So if it's possible, if you haven't signed up for this Awakening to Whiteness curriculum, and that's still a possibility, that would be wonderful, or other opportunities like it, particularly because, like I was saying, Sangha, here you already have a group of people where there's relationships and connection and seeing each other as whole individuals. I was just hearing just a little bit about people's gardens and people's employment status, and you know, people are real with each other, and that opens the door to say, and let me share with you some of the moments in life where I was not at my best, where I was acting out of habit pattern. So that's my thought.
Thank you. About 3 years ago, I took a one-day workshop from a retired teacher, and he taught at, I think, massage school. And he said that experiencing, recognizing that we have some shame helps keep us a balanced, a psychologically healthy human being. And when I think recently about what I have some shame around, I think it helps me open up to a humility that I need to recognize in this landscape of my white privilege. And I've always felt that, or been told by other counselors, that guilt is a junk food emotion. It's a screen over the deeper place where we need to look inside.
Shame, understanding shame is really important, and at least the way that it's contexted in shame resilience work. And I recognize that language is flexible and fluid, and people use it in a variety of ways. Shame and guilt are seen as maybe not exactly opposites, but approximate opposites. So shame is the experience, the painful experience of being worthless, being unlovable, unworthy of being part of the human community, and all the tightening and like I said, trauma that goes along with that, and numbing and what have you. And guilt is the recognition of, I have values that my actions are not currently lining up with. And that is actually that is encouragement. When we're able to recognize, I would like to run I haven't run in a while, so that's a bad analogy to start with. I would like to start a sangha. I was about to start a sangha when the pandemic started. I was looking for a place. So it's a value of mine to share the Dharma. And my ability to do that in this time and place is not where I would like for it to be. If I can just honestly acknowledge, oh, that is what it is. That's unfortunate. Or in that moment, I was embodying racist understanding. In that moment, as an 18-year-old college student, I was not embodying the values that if you had asked me what my values were, they were out of alignment. That actually draws us. It has a greater potential to draw us up. And because shame is has such a charge as a word, I find often as a person who studies, who practices shame resilience, that people often use the word guilt when they mean shame, or they use the word embarrassed or humiliated when they mean shame. So part of being resilient to shame is understanding how we experience it in ourselves and understanding what it's not. And just one other piece that I as an addiction counselor, I would lead people through a 14 to 16 week course on shame and shame resilience, because shame and addiction, you can't even pull them apart. Like, when you're feeling ashamed, how quickly do you go to your coping? How quickly do you reach for the ice cream? How quickly do you, you know, hop on social media and tune out? How quickly do you go buy something, binge watch a show, you know, fill in the blank? the part of the process of unpacking shame is like I said, being able to acknowledge it to someone who is able to hear it in an embracing and spacious place, without judgment, without a, man, you really screwed that up, didn't you? Oh boy, right? And so again, right here, you have this sangha of individuals who you've been practicing with for, I don't even know how long, who understand and are doing their own work. This is just such a, sangha is such an amazing opportunity for healing. Even though the work is hard. I apologize if I veered off from your question, Ruthann.
Oh no, thank you so much. I just think the work is hard, but it was the old thing during Vietnam, not to decide is to decide, you know. It's not easy being human, but why miss out on the good side of what can be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, we need imagination. So look at all the bravery from the people who've been and are victims.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that makes a great point. Coming back to Sam's question of where to start, I feel like it's such a better place to start from inspiration, right? Finding the people who are inspiring, like, oh my goodness. Like, I look at the work that Brené Brown is doing, and part of the reason that I feel like she is such an inspiration for us is she is not the guru up on the mountain that's saying, I have this all figured out. She's like, and here's how I screwed up today, you know, and I processed it and I thought it through and I've done my shame resilience work. So to the point that I can now share it with you. That is very inspiring, much more inspiring than somebody who is presenting as if they've got it all figured out.
Hi, this is Bruce.
Hey, Bruce.
Could you please repeat very slowly that quote that you started with? Because I would like to write that down.
This is the Carl Jung quote?
Pardon me?
We're talking about the Carl Jung quote?
It was the very first thing you said, because I don't know. I don't remember.
Okay. The first quote that I said was, one does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious.
Okay.
And then he goes on to say, this procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not very popular.
Yeah. Okay.
Which feels like an important part to remember.
And that was Carl Jung?
That was Carl Jung.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you for being here today, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for being here, Bruce.
Hello. Well, I can you hear me okay?
Yes,
I'm trying not to disturb somebody in the other room here. I've kind of recently, only in the past couple of years, come to understand my childhood through the lens of someone, a Jewish person in Charleston, West Virginia in the 1970s. Mm. So, I've kind of come to the, when I look at it from, you know, back here now, I'm kind of like, I wasn't really white.
Mm.
I passed for white because the kids in my neighborhood and the kids at my school, the white kids, because it was a very, very mixed, it was more like Norfolk in my neighborhood. We were that Jewish family.
Mm-hmm.
And I distinctly remember a kid very close to my house playing outside, and a boy saying, "Well, I can't play with you because my daddy said you killed Jesus." Hmm. And they called me Christ killer and dirty Jew, and I was beaten up. They took my lunch. It was bad. It was traumatic. But the black kids in school, they never bothered me. And when they saw me being bothered, they kind of gave me the look, this look, like, I get it, mm-hmm. you know? And I had a particularly bad incident in the hallway. And I came into, I was a black teacher, and I was crying. And she said, "Little girl, why are you crying?" And I said, "'Cause they called me a dirty Jew." And she said, "Little girl, they called me the N-word every day. So you just stop your crying." And then she just went on teaching. That was it. It was all she said. And it was like, and it actually, as stern as she was, it actually really helped me. But, you know, since then, I'm a blues musician, so I have a lot of black friends. And I have been accused of being too comfortable at times. And I remember there's actually a friend that's from the Sangha, a black woman, who basically said, you know, why do you talk to me about race matters, you know, that are in the news or what? Why do you talk to me about that? Because if you are, you know, looking at me like, oh, you're my black friend, then you're objectifying me. Hmm. You know, you're objectifying me in that way. And it was like, wow, that was enlightening. Because I've actually had a few of my black friends tell me that they've had people, since the George Floyd thing, they've had people calling them. And like, "Hey, I'm checking in with you. Are you okay?" And like, even like giving them gifts and sending them money as if they're making reparations or something. It's that shame.
Yeah.
And kind of this, again, it's another form of objectification. And that was really enlightening to me, what this friend said, you know. Don't just see me through that lens, please.
Right.
When these matters come up in the news, you know.
Right. Yeah, I'm so appreciative of you sharing your experience and how your identities, you know, also experience oppression. You know, we've all experienced our version, and it's not a race or a comparison. And pain is pain.
Yeah. Well, what was different is I could walk down the street in a neighborhood where they didn't know I was that Jewish kid.
Right.
And nobody would bother me. Right. So, you know, and then when I moved to Oregon, you know, that changed, it just stopped.
Yeah.
It just stopped. So that was then my white privilege right there.
Right. Yeah. Cause it's, passing is never about passing as a person of color. It's always about, can you pass as white, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a great, that your story shares a great example of how we can have really good intentions. You know, we want to check in with somebody because we're concerned and we're trying, our heart's in the right place. And just through ignorance, just through ignorance through not understanding, it ends up being received. I have a priest friend who was marching with their friend who's a person of color, and in Massachusetts, and the person of color, you know, put their fist up, and she said, she checked in with her. She's like, "I feel like putting my fist up too." And this woman passes as white, would be identified as white. And her friend, her black friend, said, "Yeah, well, put your fist up then." And so they walked through with their fist up, and that was all good and well. And then later she shared that story. She was feeling like, good, I was, you know, I was marching, I was protesting, I was expressing my voice, using my whiteness to try and support people of color, and sharing it with another person of color who said, "You shouldn't do that," right? So this is part of the challenge is that there is no right answer, right? There is no perfect, which is yet another way that shame creeps in there, right? Perfectionism, whether it's you want to be the good student, you want to be the good white person, you want to be whatever, is about if I did it perfectly, I could avoid or at least minimize shame, blame, criticism. Not an option, right? If we put ourselves out there long enough, consistently, we're gonna fall short, we're gonna get criticized, and it's not, the goal has to not be that, right? Because that's just another trip to get to avoid, to stay comfortable, right? Yeah, it's more about, can we be real?
Hi, Yushin.
Yes. This is Yoshisoki.
Yeah, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you.
From my experience and learning your explanations of shame and guilt are spot on.
Hmm.
Just spot on.
Hmm.
And when I grew up in Hollis, New York, and we moved a little further out, and I can remember, it's kind of like what someone was saying, well, then we were the Jewish family, and we were not allowed to participate and do things. And I would just say, I don't know why not?
Right.
I don't get it. I'm just a little kid. I also know the very, very, very first person when I was still a baby, whoever I felt love from and for was a Black woman from Jamaica.
Hmm.
She's in my life briefly, but was the only embodiment I had that was any sort of mother. Very, very precious. Anyway, when we went to school, I ended up going to a school that was mostly white, and my only friend happened to be the only Black person in our class. And I still remember her name, and I've often wondered how she is. We would get to school early. We would play badminton together, play basketball together. Sometimes she'd sleep at my house. Sometimes I would go to her house. But sometimes, and I never understood this, she would get really upset. And like she'd start intentionally throwing the ball hard at me or try to pin me on the wall and hit me with the ball. And it was confusing for me because I said, you're my friend, I don't get this. But I think it was also, I was a safe person. And she would share with me how hard it was for her to live. You know, she was having, you know, it was in the days of when you had to straighten your hair. She didn't want to have to straighten her hair. She wanted her hair to be natural. All these little things that were requirements upon her that were not requirements on me, not at all. And how she felt so isolated and alone. And then one year she wasn't back in our class and I didn't hear from her again. I'm really hoping that she went into an inner city school where she could be with more people of color. I still was so confused because this is still I've seen her as my friend. And now it wasn't, and then I lived actually in Rochester, New York, which is a totally 50-50 integrated community. And it was just wonderful. I enjoyed it so much. And then when I came out west, I'm like in the land of Melba toast. And it's like, where are the neighborhoods? Where are the people? This is just like flatlands in terms of people. And it was only much later when I took classes on racism that I finally understood the deep pain that my early childhood friend was having to endure. The advertising, the insidious advertising, you know, whether it's on TV or news, you know, in magazines, I mean, it was just everywhere. And that's what she was trying to convey to me. Mm-hmm. And I was blind. You know, I wasn't able to offer her, I could offer her friendship, but I couldn't really offer the empathy and the comfort that she was really asking of me, because I was so ignorant, and the racism was so prevalent that I had it. And I had it just by virtue of the fact that I didn't really understand and grasp the pain of her isolation. Even if I, you know, this Jewish girl, blah, 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 it's not the same, you know? It just wasn't the same. So I'm very grateful for that class, and I still carry her in my heart. And I hope, I just hope, you know, she's found some way to feel whole in herself, not feeling guilt and shame, feel that she's fully able to participate. And I miss her friend as her friend too, even though it's long ago, and I'm a completely different person now than I was then. And also, you mentioned about being in that class. I went to a class here where, again, I was the minority white. And it was very much with the intention of having the white person feel what it's like when you come into the room and you don't know, you don't fit in with anybody here. And yeah, I could feel that tension and that tightening, even though, yeah, I loved living in Rochester. It was a 50-50 population, blah, 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 blah. It still gave me another layer of understanding, you know, in that discomfort. I had another layer of understanding and could develop some empathy and also see, whoa, I've been so blind. Mm-hmm. So blind, and then just move forward from there. Yeah. So I just want to share, I thank you for your talk.
Yeah, thank you so much. And doesn't it take so much courage to recognize the places where we've fallen short and also hold it with compassion, like just being a little girl, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. How realistic is it to that you would know about all the ways that whiteness has been presented as beauty, right? To have straight hair is beauty. To have light skin is beauty. To have thin lips is beauty.
Even some of the ads that they have where they're marketing soaps, yeah, where they say you can clean and purify your life, and they actually start, some of these big names start with black people, and as they're washing and they transform and take off their clothes, they become a white person.
Mm-hmm.
Like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Very perversive.
There is so much more work to do. So much more work to do than from where we are. And it feels just like the Dharma, that just like, you know, the official Dharma teachings, that, you know, the suttas, that there's so much towards awakening, and it is possible. The Buddha said, I wouldn't be teaching this if it wasn't possible. I wouldn't bother, right? And it's the same with racism. There's so much to do, and it is possible for us to decolonize our minds. And I know that there are many different, it's a Buddhist-centric perspective, but I feel like the Dharma really sets us up well to engage in these conversations, to be with our discomfort, know, I was thinking that occurred to me as sitting, I forgot to mention this in the talk, but like often the image or the image that I've heard about week-long retreats, sesshin, is that you don't know how your mind works until you put it in a container like a sesshin. And the image that goes along with it is a snake doesn't know how it moves until it's put in a bamboo tube, right? Suddenly it becomes very clear. And I did not think that I had been trained to be afraid of people based on this until I was surrounded by people. I was outnumbered by people of color. Suddenly it was glaringly obvious. So it takes being willing to be uncomfortable. Final thought?
I have a question. You said you're from New Jersey?
Originally, yes.
Where? What part?
From the Jersey Shore, Point Pleasant Beach.
Okay, I'm from New Jersey too, from Westfield.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah. That we come with some East Coast edge, and then we get softened up a little bit by the West Coast.
You've lost your accents.
I have lost the accent. I watched a lot of TV, I think. I don't know that I ever got the accent. Yeah. Well, I am so grateful for this opportunity. I'm so grateful to hear the work that you all are doing as a Sangha to turn this Dharma eye towards racism. It's such important work. And grateful for the opportunity. As I understand it, Domyo ends with the phrase, which I will do now. Like a lotus abiding in muddy water, mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. Om Buddha throughout space and time. All honor once Bodhi Sanvas Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Mahamrajna Parami.
Thank you. Good luck with your
thank you.
Center.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Hello, Vin.
Hello.
It's been a long time.
This is true. How you doing?
Good.
What, flashed out of you there. Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's the Zoom problem. Yes. I'm still in Vancouver.
Oh, okay. Cool.
But I've been listening to the podcasts, but then sort of belatedly realized that I could attend now. So I'm doing that.
Well, I'm glad.
Which Vancouver?
Vancouver, Washington, right across the
river. Oh, okay. So yeah. But, can't meet in person anymore. So
no.
None of us can.
Yeah.
But this is good. This is much better than not meeting at all.
Very much so. Thank goodness for Zoom. I mean, I can't imagine if this had happened 20, 25 years ago. Just be impossible.
Yeah.
I'm doing band meetings, AA meetings, all kinds of stuff. It's been really great. Rehearsals, everything.
Excellent.
So, yeah. It's good to see you guys.
Good to see everybody here.
So, yeah. So now I'm off to another Zoom meeting, actually. Okay. Bye. Okay.
Bye-bye.
Everybody.
Bye, Shoketsu.
Bye.